runs and water sprays all over Britt-Marie's jacket. They say people change when they go away, which is why Britt-Marie has always loathed travelling. She doesn't want change, so it must be on account of the travelling, she decides afterwards, that she now loses her self-possession as never before. Unless you count the time Kent walked across the parquet floor in his golf shoes soon after they were married. She picks up the mop and starts beating the coffee machine with the handle as hard as she can. It blinks, something smashes. It stops blinking. Britt-Marie keeps hitting it until her arms are trembling and her eyes can no longer make out the contours of the draining board. Finally, out of breath, she fetches a towel from her handbag, turns off the ceiling light in the kitchen, sits down on one of the wooden stools in the darkness, and weeps into the towel. She doesn't want her tears to drip onto the floor. They could leave marks. Chapter 7. Britt-Marie stays awake all night. She's used to that, as people are when they've lived their entire lives for someone else. She sits in the dark, of course, otherwise what would people think if they walked by and saw the light left on as if there was some criminal inside? But she doesn't sleep, because she remembers the thick layer of dust on the floor of the recreation centre before she started cleaning, and if she dies in her sleep, she's certainly not going to risk lying here until she starts smelling and gets all covered in dust. Sleeping on one of the sofas in the corner of the recreation centre is not even worth thinking about, because they were so filthy that Britt-Marie had to wear double latex gloves when she covered them with bicarbonate of soda. Maybe she could have slept in the car, maybe if she were an animal. The girl at the unemployment office kept insisting that there was a hotel in the town 20 kilometres away, but Britt-Marie can't even think of staying another night in a place where other people have made her bed. She knows that there are some people who do nothing else but dream of going away and experiencing something different. But Britt-Marie dreams of staying at home, where everything is always the same. She wants to make her own bed. Anytime she and Kent are staying at a hotel, she always puts up the Do Not Disturb sign and then makes the bed and cleans the room herself. It's not because she judges people, not at all. It's because she knows that the cleaning staff could very well be the sort of people who judge people, and Britt-Marie certainly doesn't want to run the risk of the cleaning staff sitting in a meeting in the evening discussing the horrible state of room 423. Once, Kent made a mistake about the check-in time for the flight when they were going home after a hotel visit, although Kent still maintains that those sods can't even write the correct time on the sodding ticket, and they had to run off in the middle of the night without even having time to take a shower. So, just before Britt-Marie rushed out of the door, she ran into the bathroom to turn on the shower for a few seconds so there would be water on the floor when the cleaning staff came, and they would therefore not come to the conclusion that the guests in room 423 had set off wearing their own dirt. Kent snorted at her and said she was always too bloody concerned about what people thought of her. Britt-Marie was screaming inside all the way to the airport. She had actually mainly been concerned about what people would think of Kent. She doesn't know when he stopped caring about what people thought of her. She knows that once upon a time, he did care. That was back in the days when he still looked at her as if he knew she was there. It's difficult to know when love blooms. Suddenly one day you wake up and it's in full flower. It works the same way when it wilts. One day it is just too late. Love has a great deal in common with balcony plants in that way. Sometimes not even bicarbonate of soda makes a difference. Britt-Marie doesn't know when their marriage slipped out of her hands, when it became worn and scratched up, no matter how many coasters she used. Once he used to hold her hand when they slept, and she dreamed his dreams. Not that Britt-Marie didn't have any dreams of her own, it was just that his were bigger, and the one with the biggest dreams always wins in this world. She had learned that. So she stayed home, to take care of his children, without even dreaming of having any of her own. She stayed home another few years to make a presentable home, and support him in his career, without dreaming of her own. She found she had neighbours who called her a nagbag, when she worried about what the Germans would think if there was rubbish in the foyer or the stairwell smelled of pizza. She made no friends of her own, just the odd acquaintance, usually the wife of one of Kent's business associates. One of them once offered to help Britt Marie with the washing up after a dinner party, and then she set about sorting Britt Marie's cutlery drawer, with knives on the left, then spoons and forks. When Britt Marie asked in a state of shock what she was doing, the acquaintance laughed as if it was a joke and said, "Does it really matter?" They were no longer acquainted. Kent said that Britt Marie was socially incompetent, so she stayed home for another few years so he could be social on behalf of the both of them. A few years turned into more years, and more years turned into all years. Years have a habit of behaving like that. It's not that Britt Marie chose not to have any expectations. She just woke up one morning and realized they were past their sell-by date. Kent's children liked her, she thinks. But children become adults, and adults refer to women of Britt Marie's type as nagbags. From time to time, there were other children living in their block. Occasionally, Britt Marie got to cook them dinner if they were home alone. But the children always had mothers or grandmothers who came home at some point, and then they grew up, and Britt Marie became a nag bag. Kent kept saying she was socially incompetent, and she assumed this had to be right. In the end, all she dreamed of was a balcony and a husband who did not walk on the parquet in his golf shoes, who occasionally put his shirt in the laundry basket without her having to ask him to do it, and who now and then said he liked the food without her having to ask. A home. Children who, although they weren't her own, came for Christmas in spite of everything, or at least tried to pretend they had a decent reason not to. A correctly organized cutlery drawer, an evening at the theatre every now and again, windows you could see the world through, someone who noticed that Britt Marie had taken special care with her hair, or at least pretended to notice, or at least let Britt Marie go on pretending. Someone who came home to a newly mopped floor and a hot dinner on the table and on the odd occasion noticed that she had made an effort. It may be that a heart only finally breaks after leaving a hospital room in which a shirt smells of pizza and perfume, but it will break more readily if it has burst a few times before. Britt Marie turns on the light at 6 o'clock the following morning. Not because she's really missing the light, but because people may have noticed the light was on last night. And if they've realized Britt Marie has spent the night at the recreation center, she doesn't want them thinking she's still asleep at this time of the morning. There's an old television by the sofas, which she could turn on to feel less lonely, but she avoids it because there will most likely be football on it. There's always football nowadays, and faced with that option, Britt Marie would actually prefer to be lonely. The recreation centre encloses her in a guarded silence. The coffee percolator lies on its side and no longer blinks at her. She sits on the stool in front of it, remembering how Kent's children said Britt Marie was passive-aggressive. Kent laughed in that way that he did after drinking vodka and orange in front of a football match, his stomach bouncing up and down and the laughter gushing forth in little snorting bursts through his nostrils. And then he replied, "She ain't bloody passive-aggressive. She's aggressive-passive." And then he laughed until he spilled vodka on the shagpile rug. That was the night Britt Marie decided she had had enough and moved the rug to the guest room without a word. Not because she's passive-aggressive, obviously, but because there are limits. She wasn't upset about what Kent had said because most likely he didn't even understand it himself. On the other hand, she was offended that he hadn't even checked to see if she was standing close enough to hear. She looks at the coffee percolator. For a fleeting, carefree moment, the thought occurs to her that she might try to mend it, but she comes to her senses and moves away from it. She hasn't mended anything since she was married. It was always best to wait until Kent came home, she felt. Kent always said, "Women can't even put together IKEA furniture," when they watched women in television programs about house building or renovation. "Quota filling," he used to call it. Britt Marie liked sitting next to him on the sofa, solving the crossword, always so close to the remote control that she could feel the tips of his fingers against her knee when he fumbled with it to flip the channel to a football match. Then she fetches more bicarbonate of soda and cleans the entire recreation center one more time. She has just sprinkled another batch of bicarbonate of soda over the sofas when there's a knock at the door. It takes Britt Marie a fair amount of time to open it, because running into the bathroom and doing her hair in front of the mirror without functioning lights is a somewhat complicated process. Somebody is sitting outside the door with a box of wine in her hands. "Ha!" says Britt Marie to the box.
"Good wine, you know, cheap, fell off the back of a lorry, huh?" says somebody, quite smugly.
Britt Marie doesn't know what that means.
"But, you know, I have to pour into bottle with label and all that crap in case tax authority asks about it," says somebody. "It's called house red in my pizzeria, if tax authority asking, okay?"
Somebody partly gives Britt Marie the box and partly throws it at her before she forces her way inside. The wheelchair slamming across the threshold to have a look around. Britt Marie looks at the goo of melted snow and gravel left behind by the wheels with marginally less horror than if it had been excrement.
"Might I ask how the repair of my car is progressing?" asks Britt Marie.
Somebody nods exultantly.
"Bloody good, bloody good. Hey, let me ask you something, Britt Marie. Do you mind about colour?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"You know, the door I got, huh? Bloody lovely door, huh? But maybe not same colour as car. Maybe more like yellow."
"What's happened to my door?" Britt Marie asks, horrified.
"Nothing, nothing, just a question, huh? Yellow door, not good. It's what's it called, oxidized, old door. Almost not yellow anymore, almost white now."
"I will certainly not tolerate a yellow door on my white car." Somebody waves the palms of her hands in circles.
"Okay, okay, okay, you know, calm. Fix white door, no problem. Don't get lemon in arse now. But white door will have, what's it called, delivery time?"
She nods at the wine in a carefree manner.
"You like wine, Britt?"
"No," answers Britt Marie. Not because she dislikes wine, but because if you say you like wine, people may come to the conclusion that you're an alcoholic.
"Everyone likes wine, Britt."
"My name is Britt Marie. Only my sister calls me Britt."
"Sister, there's what's it called, another one of you. Nice for the world."
Somebody grins, as if this is a joke. At Britt Marie's expense, Britt Marie assumes. "My sister died when we were small," she informs somebody, without taking her eyes off the wine box.
"Ah, what the hell, condole,
says somebody, sadly. Britt Marie curls up her toes tightly in her shoes. "Ha, that's nice of you," she says, quietly.
"The wine is good, but a bit, muddy. You have to strain it a few times with a coffee filter, huh? Everything okay then?"
she explains expertly before looking at Britt Marie's bag and Britt Marie's balcony boxes on the floor. Her smile grows.
"I wanted to give to you, you know, as your congratulations for new job present, but now I can see it's more like a, moving in present."
Offended, Britt Marie holds the box of wine in front of her as if it's making a ticking sound. "I'd like to point out to you that I don't live here."
"Where did you sleep last night, then?"
"I didn't sleep," says Britt Marie, looking as if she'd like to toss the wine box out of the door and cover her ears.
"There's one of them hotels, you know," says somebody.
"Huh. I suppose you also have a hotel on your premises. I could imagine you do. Pizzeria and car workshop and post office and grocer's shop and a hotel must be nice for you never having to make up your mind." Somebody's face collapses with undisguised surprise.
"Hotel? Why would I have one of those? No, 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 Britt Marie, I keep to my, core activity."
Britt Marie shifts her weight from left foot to right and finally goes to the refrigerator and puts the wine box inside. "I don't like hotels," she announces and closes the door firmly.
"No, damn it, don't put wine in fridge, you get lumps in it," yells somebody.
Britt Marie glares at her. Is it really necessary to swear all the time as if we were a horde of barbarians?
Somebody propels her chair forward and tugs at the kitchen drawers until she finds the coffee filters.
Shit. Britt Marie. I show. You must filter. It's okay. Or, you know, mix with Fanta. I have cheap Fanta, if you want. From China.
She stops herself when she notices the coffee percolator, the remains of it at least. Britt Marie, filled with discomfort, clasps her hands together over her stomach and looks as if she'd like to brush some invisible specks of dust from the opening of a black hole and then sink into it herself.
What happened?
Asks somebody, eyeing first the mop and then the mop-sized dents in the coffee percolator. Britt Marie stands in silence with flaming cheeks. She may quite possibly be thinking about Kent. Finally, she clears her throat, straightens her back, and looks somebody right in the eye as she answers,
"Hit by a flying stone."
Somebody looks at her, looks at the coffee machine, looks at the mop. Then she starts laughing, loudly, then coughing, then laughing even louder. Britt Marie is deeply offended. It wasn't meant to be funny. At least, she doesn't think it was. She hasn't said anything that was supposed to be funny in years, as far as she can remember. So she's offended by the laughter because she assumes it's at her expense and not because of the actual joke. It's the sort of thing you assume if you've spent a sufficient amount of time with a husband who is constantly trying to be funny. There was not space in their relationship for more hilarity than his. Kent was funny. And Britt Marie went into the kitchen and took care of the washing up. That was how they divided up their responsibilities. But now somebody sits here laughing so much that her wheelchair almost topples over. This makes Britt Marie insecure, and her natural reaction to insecurity is irritation. She goes to the vacuum cleaner in a very demonstrative way to attack the sofa covers, which are covered in bicarbonate of soda. Somebody's laughter slowly turns into a titter. And then into a general mumbling about flying stones.
That's bloody funny, you know, hey, you know, there's a bloody big package in your car.
As if this would in any way be a surprise to Britt Marie. Britt Marie can still hear a trace of tittering in her voice. I'm well aware of that, she says, tersely. She can hear somebody rolling her wheelchair towards the front door.
You want, you know, some help carrying it inside?
Britt Marie turns on the vacuum cleaner by way of an answer. Somebody yells to make herself heard.
It's no trouble, Britt Marie!
Britt Marie rubs the nozzle as hard as she can over the sofa cushions. Repeatedly until somebody gives up and yells.
Well, you know, a Fanta, like I said, if you want some for wine.
And pizza.
Then the door closes. Britt Marie turns off the vacuum cleaner. She doesn't want to be unfriendly, but she really doesn't want any help with the package. Nothing is more important to Britt Marie right now than her reluctance to be helped with the package. Because there's a piece of furniture from IKEA inside. And Britt Marie is going to assemble it herself. Chapter 8. From time to time, a truck drives through Borg, and whenever this happens, the recreation centre shakes violently, as if Britt Marie thinks it was built on the fault line between two continental shelves. Continental shelves are common in crossword puzzles, so it's the sort of thing she knows about. She also knows that Borg is the kind of place Britt Marie's mother used to describe as the back of beyond, because that was how Britt Marie's mother used to describe the countryside. Yet another truck thunders past, a green one. The walls shake. Borg used to be the sort of community trucks came home to, but nowadays they only drive past. The truck makes her think of Ingrid. She remembers that she had time to see it through the back window when she was a child, on the very last day that she can recall thinking of herself as such. It was also green. Britt Marie has wondered the same thing an infinite number of times over the years, whether she had time to scream, and whether it would have made a difference. Their mother had told Ingrid to put on her belt, because Ingrid never put her belt on, and for that exact reason Ingrid had not put it on. They were arguing. That's why they didn't see it. Britt Marie saw it because she always put her belt on, because she wanted her mother to notice, which she obviously never did, because Britt Marie never had to be noticed, for the simple reason that she always did everything without having to be told. It came from the right-hand side. Green. That's one of the few things Britt Marie remembers. It came from the right, and there was glass and blood all over the back seat of their parents' car. The last thing Britt Marie remembered before she passed out was that she wanted to clean it up, make it nice. And when she woke up at the hospital, that is precisely what she did. Clean. Make things nice. When they buried her sister, and there were strangers in black clothes drinking coffee in her parents' home, Britt Marie put coasters under all the cups and washed up all the dishes and cleaned all the windows. When her father began to stay at work for longer and longer, and her mother stopped talking altogether, Britt Marie cleaned, 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 and cleaned. She hoped that sooner or later her mother would get out of bed and say, "How nice you've made everything!" But it never happened. They never spoke about the accident, and because they didn't, they also couldn't talk about anything else. Some people had pulled Britt Marie out of the car, she doesn't know who, but she knows that her mother, silently furious, never forgave them for saving the wrong daughter. Maybe Britt Marie didn't forgive them either, because they saved the life of a person who, from that day, devoted herself to just walking around being afraid of dying and lying there stinking. One day, she read her father's morning newspaper and saw an advertisement for a brand of window cleaner. And in this way, a life went by. Now she's 63 and she's standing at the back of Beyond, looking out at Borg through the kitchen window of the recreation centre, missing Faxin and her view of the world. Obviously, she stands far enough from the window for no one outside to be able to see her looking out. What sort of impression would that make? As if she just stood there all day, staring out like some criminal. But her car is still parked in the gravelled courtyard. She has accidentally left her keys inside, and the IKEA package is still in the back seat. She doesn't know exactly how she's supposed to get it inside the recreation centre because it's so very heavy. She can't really say why it's so heavy because she doesn't know exactly what's inside. The idea was to buy a stool, not unlike the two stools in the kitchen at the recreation centre, but after she had made her way to the IKEA self-service warehouse and found the appropriate shelf, she found that all the stools had been sold. Britt Marie had taken all morning to make the decision that she was going to buy and assemble a stool, so this anticlimax left her standing there, frozen to the spot, for such a length of time that she began to worry that someone in the warehouse would see her there looking mysterious. What would people think? Most likely that she was planning to steal something. Once this thought was firmly established, Britt Marie panicked and with superhuman powers managed to drag over the next available package to her cart, in almost every conceivable way managing to convey the impression that this was the package she had been after all along. She hardly remembers how she got it into the car. She supposes that she was overcome with that syndrome they often talk about on the TV when mothers pick up huge boulders under which their children are lying trapped. Britt Marie is invested with that sort of power when she starts entertaining suspicions of strangers looking at her and wondering whether she's a criminal. She moves further away from the window just to be on the safe side. At exactly 12 o'clock, she prepares the table by the sofas for lunch. Not that there's much of either a table or a lunch, just a tin of peanuts and a glass of water, but the fact is that civilized people have lunch at 12, and if Britt Marie is anything in this world, she's certainly civilized. She spreads a towel on the sofa before she sits down, then empties the tin of peanuts onto a plate. She has to force herself not to try to eat them with a knife and fork. Then she washes up and cleans the whole recreation centre again, so carefully that she almost uses up her whole supply of bicarbonate of soda. There's a little laundry room with a washing machine and a tumble dryer. Britt Marie cleans the machines with her last bit of bicarbonate of soda, like a starving person putting out her last bait on her fishing line. Not that she was thinking of doing any washing, but she can't bear the thought of them all dirty. In a corner behind the tumble dryer, she finds a whole sack of white shirts with numbers on them. Football jerseys, she understands. The entire recreation centre is hung with pictures of various people wearing those shirts. Very likely they're covered in grass stains, of course. Britt Marie can't for the life of her understand why anyone would choose to practice an outdoor sport while wearing white jerseys. It's barbaric. She wonders whether the corner shop, pizzeria, car workshop, post office would even be likely to sell bicarbonate of soda. She fetches her coat. Just inside the front door, next to several photos of footballs and people who don't know any better than to kick them, hangs a yellow jersey with the word BANK printed above the number 10. Just beneath is a photo of an old man holding up the same jersey with a proud smile. Britt Marie puts on her coat. Outside the front door is a person who is clearly just about to knock on it. The person has a face, and the face is full of snuff. This, in every possible way, is an awful way of establishing the very short-lived acquaintance between Britt Marie and the face, because Britt Marie loathes snuff. The whole thing is over in 20 seconds, when the snuff face moves off while mumbling something that sounds distinctly like nagbag. At which point, Britt Marie picks up her telephone and dials the number of the only person her telephone has ever called. The girl at the unemployment office doesn't answer. Britt Marie calls again, because actually a telephone is not a thing you decide whether or not to answer. "Yes," says the girl at long last with food in her mouth. "Sorry, I'm having my lunch." "Now," Britt Marie exclaims, as if the girl was joking. "My dear girl, we're not at war. Surely it's not necessary to be having your lunch at 1:30? The girl chews her lunch quite hard, bravely tries to change the topic of conversation. "Did the pest control man come? I had to spend hours calling around, but in the end I found someone who promised to make an emergency visit, and she was a pest control woman who took snuff," Britt Marie goes on, as if this explains everything. "Right," says the girl again. "So did she deal with the rat?" "No, she most certainly did not," Britt Marie affirms. "She came in here wearing dirty shoes, and I'd just mopped the floor, taking snuff as well, she was. Said she was putting out poison, that's how she put it, and you can't just do that. Do you really think one can just do that, put out poison just like that?" "No," guesses the girl. "No, you actually can't. Someone could die, and that's what I said. And then she stood there, rolling her eyes with her dirty shoes and her snuff, and she said she'd put out a trap instead and bait it with Snickers, chocolate, on my newly mopped floor." Britt Marie says all this in the voice of someone screaming inside. "Okay," says the girl, and immediately wishes she hadn't, because she realizes it is not okay at all. "So I said it will have to be poison then, and do you know what she told me? Listen to this. She said if the rat eats the poison, you can't know for certain where it will go to die. It could die in a cavity in the wall and lie there stinking. Have you ever heard of such a thing? Do you know that you called in a woman who takes snuff and thinks it's absolutely in order to let dead animals die in the walls and stink the place out?"
"I was only trying to help," says the girl.
"A fine lot of help that was. Some of us actually have other things to do than hanging about dealing with pest control women all day long," says Britt Marie, well-meaningly.
"I couldn't agree more," says the girl. There's a queue in the corner shop, or the pizzeria, or the post office, or the car workshop, or whatever it is. Either way, there's a queue, in the middle of the afternoon, as if people here don't have anything better to do at this time. The men with beards and caps are drinking coffee and reading the newspapers at one of the tables. Carl is standing at the front of the queue. He's picking up a parcel. How very nice for him, thinks Britt Marie, having all this leisure time on his hands. A cuboid woman in her 30s stands in front of Britt Marie, wearing her sunglasses. Indoors, very modern, muses Britt Marie. She has a white dog with her. Britt Marie can't think it's very hygienic. The woman buys a pack of butter and 6 beers with foreign lettering on the cans, which somebody produces from behind the counter.
Also, 4 packs of bacon and more chocolate biscuits than Brit Marie believes any civilized person could possibly need. Somebody asks if she'd like to have it on credit. The woman nods grumpily and throws it all in a bag. Brit Marie would obviously never consider the woman to be fat, because Brit Marie is absolutely not the kind of person who pigeonholes people like that. But it does strike her how wonderful it must be for the woman to go through life so untroubled by her cholesterol levels.
"Are you blind or what?"
the woman roars as she turns around and charges directly into Brit Marie. Brit Marie opens her eyes wide in surprise, adjusts her hair. "I most certainly am not. I have quite perfect vision. I've spoken to my optician about it."
"You have quite perfect vision," he said. "In that case, could you possibly get out of the way?"
grunts the woman and waves a stick at her. Brit Marie looks at the stick, looks at the dog and the sunglasses. She mumbles, "Ha, ha, ha," and nods apologetically before she realizes that nodding won't make any difference. The blind woman and the dog walk through her more than they walk past her. The door tinkles cheerfully behind them. It doesn't have the sense to do anything else. Somebody rolls past Brit Marie and waves encouragingly at her.
"Don't worry about her. She's like Carl. Lemon up her arse, you know."
She makes a gesture with her arm, which Brit Marie feels is supposed to indicate how far up the latter the former is stuck, and then piles up a stack of empty pizza boxes on the counter. Brit Marie adjusts her hair and adjusts her skirt and instinctively adjusts the topmost pizza box, which isn't quite straight, and then tries to adjust her dignity as well, and say in a tone that is absolutely considerate,
"I should like to know how the repair of my car is progressing."
Somebody scratches her hair.
"Sure, sure, sure, that car, yeah, you know. I have something to ask you, Brit Marie. Is a door important to Brit Marie?"
"Door? Why? What in the world do you mean?"
"You know, only asking. Colour. Important for Brit Marie, I understand. Yellow door? Not okay. So I ask you, Brit Marie, is a door important to Brit Marie? If not important, then Brit Marie's car is, what's it called? Finish repaired. If a door is important, you know, maybe, what's it called? Longer delivery time."
She looks pleased. Brit Marie does not look pleased.
"For goodness sake, I must have a door on the car," she fumes.
Somebody waves the palms of her hands defensively.
"Sure, sure, sure. No, get angry. Just ask. Door a little longer."
She measures out a few centimetres in the air between her thumb and index finger to illustrate how short a period of time a little longer really is. Brit Marie realises that the woman has the upper hand in these negotiations. "Kent should have been here. He loves negotiating. He always says you have to compliment the person you're negotiating with." So Brit Marie collects herself and says, "Here in Borg, people seem to have all the time in the world to go shopping in the afternoon. It must be nice for you to have so much leisure." Somebody raises her eyebrows.
"And you? You're very busy?"
With a deep patience, Brit Marie puts one hand in the other.
"I am extremely busy. Very, very busy indeed. But as it happens, I am out of bicarbonate of soda. Do you sell bicarbonate of soda in this shop?" She says the word shop with divine indulgence.
"Vega!"
Somebody roars at once so that Brit Marie jumps into the air and almost knocks over the pile of pizza boxes. The child from yesterday turns up behind the counter, still holding the football. Beside her stands a boy who looks almost exactly the same as her, but with longer hair.
"Bicarbonate of soda for the lady,"
says somebody, with an exaggerated theatrical bow at Brit Marie, which is not at all appreciated.
"It's her," whispers Vega to the boy.
The boy immediately looks as if Brit Marie is a lost key. He runs into the stockroom and stumbles back out with 2 bottles in his arms. Faxin. All the air goes out of Brit Marie. She assumes that she has what is sometimes in crossword clues known as an out-of-body experience. For a few moments she forgets all about the grocery shop and the pizzeria and the men with beards and cups of coffee and newspapers. Her heart beats as if it's just been released from prison. The boy places the bottles on the counter like a cat that's caught a squirrel. Britt Marie's fingers brush over them before her sense of dignity orders them to leave off. It's like coming home.
I was under the impression that they'd been discontinued, she whispers.
The boy points eagerly at himself.
Chill! Omar fixes everything.
He points even more eagerly at the bottles of Faxin.
All the foreign trucks stop at the petrol station in town. I know them all there. I fix whatever you like.
Somebody nods wisely.
They shut down petrol station in Borg. Not, you know, profitable. But I fix petrol in Cannes if you like. Free home delivery and I can get you more Faxin if you want,
the boy hollers. Vega rolls her eyes.
I'm the one who told you she needed Faxin, she hisses at the boy, and puts the jar of bicarbonate of soda on the counter.
I'm the one who fixed it,
the boy maintains, without taking his eyes off Britt Marie.
This is my younger brother Omar, sighs Vega to Britt Marie. We're born the same year, protests Omar.
In January, in December, here, snorts Vega.
If anything, Britt Marie notices, the brother looks slightly older than her. Still a child, but approaching that age when they can become quite pungent.
I'm the best fixer in Borg, the king of the castle, you know. Whatever you need, come to me,
says Omar to Britt Marie, winking confidently without paying any attention to his sister, who's kicking him on the shin.
Twit, says Vega with a sigh.
Cow,
answers Omar. Britt Marie doesn't know if she should be concerned or proud that she actually knows that this means something bad, but she doesn't have much time to reflect on this before Omar is lying on the floor, holding his lip. Vega goes out of the door with the football in one hand and the other hand still formed into a fist. Somebody titters at Omar.
You have, what's it called, marshmallows for brains. Never learn, do you?
Omar wipes his lip and then looks as if he's letting go of the whole business, like a small child forgetting to cry over a dropped ice cream when he catches sight of a glittering Powerball.
If you want new hubcaps for your car, I can fix it. Or anything. Shampoo or handbags or anything. I'll fix it.
Maybe some plasters?
Hollers somebody mischievously and points at his lip. Britt Marie keeps a firm grip on her handbag and adjusts her hair, as if the boy has offended the both of them.
I certainly don't need either shampoo or a handbag.
Omar points at the bottles of Faxin.
Those are 30 kroner each, but you can have them on credit.
On credit?
Everyone shops on credit in Borg. I certainly don't shop on credit. I can see maybe you don't understand such a thing in Borg, but there are some of us that can pay our way, hisses Britt Marie.
That last bit just slips out of her. It wasn't quite how she meant to put it. Somebody is not grinning anymore. Both the boy and Britt Marie have red faces, caused by different kinds of shame. Britt Marie briskly lays down the money on the counter, and the boy picks it up and runs out of the door. Soon the thumping can be heard again. Britt Marie stays where she is and tries to avoid somebody's eyes.
I didn't get a receipt,
Britt Marie states in a low voice, which is not at all incriminating. Somebody shakes her head and smacks her tongue.
What does it look like? IKEA or something. He doesn't have, what's it called, limited company, you know, just a kid with a bicycle.
Huh, says Britt Marie.
What else you want?
Asks somebody, her tone noticeably less hospitable as she puts the jar of bicarbonate of soda and the bottles of Faxin in a bag. Britt Marie smiles as helpfully as she can.
You have to understand that one has to get a receipt, otherwise one actually can't prove that one isn't a criminal, she explains.
Somebody rolls her eyes, which Britt Marie feels is unnecessary. Somebody presses a few keys on her till. The money tray opens, revealing not very much money at all inside, and then the till spits out a pale yellow receipt.
That'll be 673 kroner and 50 øre, says somebody.
Britt-Marie stares back as if she's got something stuck in her throat.
For bicarbonate of soda.
Somebody points out of the door.
For dent. In car. I have done one of those, what's it called, bodywork inspection. I don't want to, what's it called, insult you, Britt-Marie, so you can't have credit. 673 kroner and 50 ore.
Britt-Marie almost drops her handbag. That's how grave the situation is.
I have... Ooh, for goodness sake, no civilized person walks around with that much cash in her handbag.
She says that in an extra loud voice so that everyone in there can hear, in case one of them is a criminal. On the other hand, only the bearded coffee-drinking men are there, and neither of them even look up. But still, criminal types do sometimes have beards. Britt-Marie actually has no prejudices about that.
Do you take cards?
She says, registering a certain amount of rising heat along her cheekbones. Somebody shakes her head hard.
Poker players do cards, Britt-Marie, here. We do cash.
Huh. In that case, I'll have to ask for directions to the nearest cash machine, says Britt-Marie.
In town, says somebody coldly, crossing her arms.
Ha!
Says Britt-Marie.
They closed down the cash machine in Borg. Not profitable, says somebody with raised eyebrows, nodding at the receipt.
Britt-Marie's gaze flickers desperately across the walls in an attempt to deflect attention from her blood-red cheeks. There's a yellow jersey hanging on the wall, identical to the one in the recreation centre, with the word bank written above the number 10 on its back. Somebody notices her looking at it, so she closes the till, knots the bag of bicarbonate of soda and vaccin, and pushes it across the counter.
You know... No shame here with credit, huh, Britt-Marie? Maybe shame where you come from, but no shame in Borg.
Britt-Marie takes the bag without knowing what to do with her eyes. Somebody takes a slug of vodka and nods at the yellow jersey on the wall.
Best player in Borg, called Bank, you know, because when Bank plays for Borg, it was like, what's it called, like money in the bank. Long time ago, before financial crisis. Then, you know, Bank got ill, huh? Like another sort of crisis, Bank moved away, gone now, huh?
She nods out of the door. A ball thumps against the fence.
Bank's old man trained all the brats, huh? Kept them going. Kept all of Borg going, huh? Everyone's friend. But God, you know, God got a shithead for numbers, huh? The sod gives both profitable and unprofitable person a heart attack. Bank's dad died a month ago.
The wooden walls creak and groan around them, as old houses do and old people. One of the men with papers and cups of coffee fetches more coffee from the counter. Britt-Marie notes that you get a free top-up here.
They found him on the, what's it called, kitchen floor.
Pardon me? Somebody points at the yellow jersey, shrugs. Bank's old man on the kitchen floor one morning, just dead. She snaps her fingers. Britt-Marie jumps. She thinks of Kent's heart attack. He had always been very profitable. She takes an even firmer grip on her bag of vaccine and bicarbonate of soda. Stands in silence for so long that somebody starts to look concerned.
Hey, you need something else? I have that, what's it called? Bailey's! Chocolate spirit! You know, it's a copy, but you can put a boy and vodka in it, and then it's okay to drink if you drink it, you know, fast.
Britt-Marie shakes her head briskly. She walks towards the door, but something about that kitchen floor may possibly cause her some hesitation. So she cautiously turns around before she changes her mind, and then turns around again. Britt-Marie is not a very spontaneous person, one certainly needs to be clear about that. Spontaneous is a synonym for irrational. That's Britt-Marie's firm view. And if there's one thing Britt-Marie isn't, it's irrational. This is not so very easy for her, in other words. But at last she turns around, then changes her mind and turns around another time, so that by the end she's facing the door when she lowers her voice and asks with all the spontaneity that she can muster.
Do you possibly stock Snickers chocolate bars?
Darkness falls early in Borg in January. Britt-Marie goes back to the recreation centre and sits by herself on one of the kitchen stools with the front door open. The chill doesn't concern her, not the waiting either. She's used to it. You do get used to it. She has plenty of time to think about whether what she is going through now is a sort of life crisis. She has read about them. People have life crises all the time. The rat comes in through the open door at 6:20. It settles on the threshold and focuses a very watchful gaze on the Snickers bar, which is on a plate on top of a little towel. Britt Marie gives the rat a stern look and cups one hand firmly in the other. From now on, we have dinner at 6:00, like civilized people. After thinking this over for a certain amount of time, she adds, "Or rats." The rat looks at the Snickers. Britt Marie has removed the wrapper and placed the chocolate in the middle of the plate, with a neatly folded napkin next to it. She looks at the rat, clears her throat. "Ha! I'm not especially good at starting these types of conversations. I'm socially incompetent, you see. That's what my husband says. He's very socially gifted, everyone says that. An entrepreneur, you see." When the rat doesn't answer, she adds, "Very successful. Very, very successful." She briefly considers telling the rat about her life crisis. She imagines she'd like to explain that it's difficult knowing who you are once you are alone, when you have always been there for the sake of someone else. But she doesn't want to trouble the rat with it, so she adjusts a crease in her skirt and says very formally, "I would like to propose a working arrangement. For your part, it would mean that a dinner would be arranged for you every evening at 6:00. She makes an explanatory gesture at the chocolate. "The arrangement, if we find it mutually beneficial, would mean that if you die, I won't let you lie and smell bad in the wall, and you will do the same for me, in case people don't know we are here." The rat takes a tentative step towards the chocolate, stretches its neck, and sniffs it. Britt Marie brushes invisible crumbs from her knee. "It's the sodium bicarbonate that disappears when one dies, you have to understand. That's why people smell. I read that after Ingrid had died." The rat's whiskers vibrate with skepticism. Britt Marie clears her throat apologetically. "Ingrid was my sister, you have to understand. She died. I was worried she'd smell bad. That's how I found out about sodium bicarbonate. The body produces sodium bicarbonate to neutralize the acidic substances in the stomach. When one dies, the body stops producing the sodium bicarbonate, so the acidic substances eat their way through the skin and end up on the floor. That's when it smells, you have to understand." She thinks about adding that she has always found it reasonable to assume that the human soul is found in the sodium bicarbonate. When it leaves the body, there's nothing left. Only complaining neighbors, but she doesn't say anything. Doesn't want to cause bother. The rat eats its dinner, but doesn't comment on whether or not it enjoyed it. Britt Marie doesn't ask. Chapter 9. Everything begins in earnest this evening. The weather is mild, the snow turns to rain as it falls from sky to earth. The children play football in the dark, but neither the dark nor the rain seems to concern them in the least. The parking area is only blessed with light here and there, where it's cast by the neon sign of the pizzeria, or from the kitchen window, where Britt Marie stands hidden behind the curtain, watching them. But, to be quite honest, most of them are so bad at football that more light would only have a marginal effect on their ability to hit the ball. The rat has gone home. Britt Marie has locked the door and washed up and cleaned the whole recreation centre one more time. She's standing by the window, looking out at the world. From time to time, the ball bounces through the puddles onto the road, and then the children play rock, paper, scissors to decide who has to go and fetch it. Kent used to tell David and Pernilla when they were small that Britt Marie couldn't play with them because she didn't know how. But that isn't true. Britt Marie knows perfectly well how to play rock, paper, scissors. She just doesn't think it sounds very hygienic to keep stones in paper bags. As for the scissors, it's not even worth thinking about. Who knows where they've been? Of course, Kent is always saying Britt Marie is so darn negative. It's a part of her social incompetence. Darn it, just be happy instead.
Kent fetches the cigars and takes care of the guests, and Britt Marie does the washing up and takes care of the home. And that's how they have divided up their lives. Kent is a bit happy, darn it. And Britt Marie is darned negative. Maybe that's how it goes. It's easier to stay optimistic if you never have to clear up the mess afterwards. The two siblings, Vega and Omar, play on opposing sides. She is calm and calculating, gently moving the ball with the insides of her feet, as you might twiddle your toes against someone you love while sleeping. Her brother, on the other hand, is angry and frustrated, hunting the ball down as if it owes him money. Britt Marie doesn't know the first thing about football, but anyone can see that Vega is the best player in the parking area, or at least the least bad one. Omar is constantly in his sister's shadow. They are all in her shadow. She reminds Britt Marie of Ingrid. Ingrid was never negative. As always with people like this, it's difficult to know whether everyone loved Ingrid because she was so positive, or if she was so positive because everyone loved her. She was 1 year older than Britt Marie and 5 centimetres taller. It doesn't take much to put someone in your shadow. It never mattered to Britt Marie that she was the one who receded into the background. She never wanted much. Sometimes she actually yearned to want something so much that she could hardly bear it. It seems so vital, wanting things, but usually the feeling passed. Ingrid, of course, was always falling to bits with wanting things, her singing career, for instance, and the celebrity status she was predestined to achieve, and the boys out there in the world who were so much more than the usual ones on offer in their apartment block. The usual boys who, Britt Marie realized, were infinitely too unusual to even look at Britt Marie, and yet were far too usual in every way to deserve her sister. They were brothers, the boys on their floor, Alf and Kent. They fought about everything. Britt Marie couldn't understand it. She followed her sister everywhere. It never bothered Ingrid. Quite the opposite. "It's you and me, Britt," she used to whisper at nights, when she told her the stories of how they were going to live in Paris, in a palace filled with servants. That was why she called her little sister Britt, because it sounded American. Admittedly, it seemed a bit obscure why you would have an American name in Paris, but Britt Marie had certainly never been the sort of person who opposed things needlessly. Vega is grim, but when her team scores in the dark yard, in the rain, in a goal made of 2 soft drink cans, her laugh sounds just like Ingrid's. Ingrid also loved to play. As with all people like that, it's difficult to know if she was the best because she loved the games, or if she loved them because she was the best. A little boy with ginger hair gets hit hard in the face with the ball. He falls headlong into a muddy puddle. Britt Marie shudders. It's the same football they shot at Britt Marie's head, and when she sees the mud on it, she wants to give herself a tetanus shot. Yet she has difficulties taking her eyes off the game, because Ingrid would have liked it. Of course, if Kent had been there, he would have said the children were playing like big girls' blouses. Kent is able to describe almost anything bad by adding before or after that it's a bit of a big girl's blouse. Britt Marie is actually not especially fond of irony, but she notes a certain amount of that very thing in the fact that the only player out there not playing like a girl's blouse is the girl. Britt Marie finally comes to her senses and leaves the window before anyone out there starts getting any ideas. It's gone 8, so the recreation centre is steeped in darkness. Britt Marie waters her balcony boxes in the dark, sprinkles bicarbonate of soda over the soil. She misses her balcony more than anything. You're never quite alone when you can stand on a balcony. You have all the cars and houses and the people in the streets. You're among them, but also not. That's the best thing about balconies. The second best thing is standing out there early in the morning before Kent has woken up, closing your eyes and feeling the wind in your hair. Britt Marie used to do that, and it felt like Paris. Of course, she has never been to Paris because Kent doesn't do any business there, but she has solved an awful lot of crossword clues about Paris. It's the world's most crossword-referenced city, full of rich and famous celebrities with their very own cleaners. Ingrid
used to go on about how they'd have their own servants, which was the only bit of the dream Britt Marie wasn't sure about. She didn't want them to think that Britt Marie's sister was so bad at cleaning that she had to employ someone to do it. Britt Marie had heard their mother talking about those sorts of mothers with contempt, and Britt Marie didn't want anyone talking about Ingrid like that. So while Ingrid would excel at everything out there in the world, Britt Marie imagined herself being really good at things inside of it, cleaning, making things nice. Her sister noticed this, noticed her. Britt Marie did her hair every morning, and her sister never forgot to say, "Thanks, you did that really well, Britt," while she turned her head in front of the mirror to a tune from one of her vinyl records. Britt Marie never had records. You don't need any when you have an older sister who truly sees you. When there's a bang on the door, Britt Marie jumps as if someone just drove an axe through it. Vega is standing outside, but without an axe. Worse still, she's dripping mud and rain on the floor. Britt Marie screams on the inside. "Why don't you turn on the lights?" asks Vega, squinting into the darkness. "They don't work, dear." "Have you tried changing the bulbs?" asks Vega with a frown, as if she has to totally control herself not to add "dear" at the end of her question. Omar pops up next to her. He has mud in his nostrils. Inside his nostrils. Britt Marie cannot get her head around how something like that could happen. Surely there's such a thing as gravity.
"You need to buy light bulbs. I have the baddest low-energy bulbs. Special price," he says eagerly, producing a rucksack from somewhere.
Vega kicks him on the shin and looks at Britt Marie with the strained diplomacy of the teenager.
"Can we watch the match here?" she asks.
"What match?" asks Britt Marie.
"The match,"
Vega replies, not entirely unlike how you'd say "the Pope" if someone asked, "What Pope?" Britt Marie switches her hands around on her stomach and then reclasps them together. "The match in what?"
"Football!"
Vega and Omar burst out. "Ha!" mutters Britt Marie and looks with revulsion at their muddy clothes. Not at the children, obviously, at their clothes. Britt Marie is obviously not revolted by children.
"He always lets us watch it here," says Vega,
and points at the photo on the wall inside the door of the elderly man with the bank jersey in his hands. In another photo just next to it stands the same man in front of a truck, and he's wearing a white jacket on which "Borb FC" is written on one of his breast pockets, and "Coach" on the other. "It could have done with a wash," Britt Marie notes.
"I have not been informed about this. You'll have to contact the man in that case."
The silence depletes the air between them of oxygen.
"He's dead,"
says Vega, at long last, looking down at her shoes. Britt Marie looks at the man in the photo, then at her hands.
"Very sad to hear it, but I actually can't be held responsible for it," she says.
Vega peers at her with hate, then shoves Omar in the side and hisses,
"Come on, Omar, let's get out of here. Never bloody mind about her."
She's already turned around and started walking away when Britt Marie notices the other children, three of them, waiting a few meters away, all in their teens. One with ginger hair, one with black, and another with high cholesterol. She senses the accusation in their eyes.
"Can I ask why you don't watch the football in the pizzeria or the car workshop or whatever it is, if it's so important?"
asks Britt Marie in a polite and not at all confrontational manner. Omar kicks his ball across the parking area and says in a quiet voice,
"They drink in there. If they lose..."
"And if they win?"
"Then they drink even more, so he always lets us watch in here."
"And I suppose in these parts you wouldn't have homes of your own to go to with televisions in them, would you?"
"There isn't space for the old team at anyone's house,"
snaps Vega suddenly. "And besides, we watch the matches together. Like a team."
Britt Marie brushes some dust off her skirt.
"I was under the impression that you didn't have a team anymore."
"We have a team,"
roars Vega, and stamps back towards Britt Marie. "We're here, aren't we? We're here, so we are a team. Even if they take our bloody pitch and our bloody club and our trainer has a bloody heart attack and goes and bloody dies on us, we're a team."
Britt-Marie is practically shaking as the child's furious eyes focus on her. This is certainly no suitable way for a human being to express herself. Her tears are now running down the child's cheeks, and Britt-Marie can't properly determine whether the child is going to give her a hug or a wallop. Britt-Marie looks as if she would find either alternative similarly threatening.
"I have to ask you to wait here," she says in a panic, and closes the door.
That's how it all happens before everything begins in earnest. Britt-Marie stands inside the door, breathing in the smell of wet potting soil and bicarbonate of soda. She remembers the smell of alcohol and the sound of Kent's football matches. He never went onto the balcony, so the balcony belonged to Britt-Marie and no one else, which was something quite unique. She always lied and said she had bought the plants because she knew he'd say something horrible if she told him she'd found them in the garbage room and sometimes in the street, left behind by some neighbours when they moved away. Plants reminded her of Ingrid, because Ingrid loved things that were alive. And for this reason, Britt-Marie repeatedly saved homeless plants to give her the strength to remember a sister whose life she was not even able to save once. You couldn't explain things like this to Kent. Kent doesn't believe in death. He believes in evolution.
"That's evolution," he said,
nodding approvingly on one occasion when he was watching a nature program in which a lion killed an injured zebra.
"It's sorting out the one that's weak, right? It's about the survival of the species, you have to get that. If you're not the best from the start, you have to accept the consequences and leave space for someone stronger, right?"
You can't discuss balcony plants with a person like that, or the feeling of missing someone. Britt-Marie's fingertips are trembling slightly when she picks up the mobile. The girl from the unemployment office answers on the third attempt.
"Hello,"
says the girl in a panting voice.
"Is that how you answer the phone? Out of breath? Britt-Marie, I'm at the gym."
"That must be very nice for you."
"Has something happened?"
"There are some children here. They say they want to see some sort of match here."
"Oh, yeah, the match. I'm going to watch it as well."
"I wasn't notified that my range of duties included taking care of children." The girl at the other end of the line groans in what is, to be honest, quite an uncalled-for way.
"Britt-Marie, sorry, but I'm not supposed to talk on the phone in the gym."
Then she exclaims without a thought.
"But, you know, it's a good thing, isn't it? If the children are there watching the football and you drop dead, they'll know all about it."
Britt-Marie laughs curtly. Then there's a silence for a very, very long time. The girl inhales grimly, and there's a sound of a jogging machine stopping.
"Okay, sorry, Britt-Marie, I was joking. It was a silly thing for me to say. I didn't mean it that way. Hello?"
Britt-Marie is already hung up. She opens the door half a minute later with the newly washed football jerseys neatly folded into a pile in her arms.
"But you're not coming in with those muddy clothes. I have just mopped the floors," she says to the children before she stops herself.
There's a policeman standing among them. He's small and chubby, and has a head of hair like a lawn the day after an impromptu barbecue. "What have you done now?" Britt-Marie hisses at Vega. The policeman looks ambivalent. The woman who stands in front of him is very different to the one the children described. Fussy, yes, and bossy clearly, but something else as well. Determined, immaculately neat, and somehow unique. He stares dumbly for a moment while he tries to think of something to say to her, but in the end decides the most civic thing he can do is to hold out a big glass jar towards Britt-Marie.
"My name is Sven. I just wanted to welcome you to Borg. This is jam."
Britt-Marie looks at the jam jar. Vega looks at Sven. At a loss, Sven scratches himself on various parts of his police uniform.
"Blueberry jam. I made it myself. I did a course in town."
Britt-Marie gives him a careful once-over from top to bottom and back again. She stops in both directions when she comes to the uniform shirt, which is tight over his stomach.
"I don't have a jersey in your size," she informs him.
Sven blushes.
"No, no, no, of course that's not what I meant. I want, just welcome to Borg, just that. That's all I wanted to say."
He presses the jam jar into Vega's hands and totters away from the threshold into the parking area, heading towards the pizzeria. Vega looks at the jam jar. Omar looks at Britt Marie's bare ring finger and grins.
"Are you married?"
he asks. Britt Marie is shocked at herself when she notices how quickly she blurts out,
"I'm divorced."
It's the first time she's said it out loud. Omar's grin widens as he nods at Sven.
"Sven is free, just so you know."
Britt Marie hears the other children tittering. She presses the jerseys into Omar's arms, snatches the jam jar from Vega, and disappears into the gloom of the recreation center. About half a dozen children remain on the threshold, rolling their eyes. That's how it all begins. Chapter 10. Football is a curious game because it doesn't ask to be loved. It demands it. Britt Marie wanders about inside the recreation center like a confounded spirit whose grave someone has opened in order to start a discotheque. The children sit on the sofa wearing the white jerseys and drinking soft drinks. Britt Marie is obviously ensured that they are sitting on towels because she doesn't have enough bicarbonate of soda to clean all the children. It goes without saying that they have coasters under their soft drinks. Admittedly, there weren't any proper coasters, so Britt Marie has used two pieces of toilet paper folded over. Necessity has no rule, but even necessity has to understand that you can't just put a soft drink can on the table. She also puts glasses in front of the children. One of them, the one that Britt Marie would obviously never refer to as overweight, but who looks as if he's had quite a few soft drinks belonging to other children, tells her cheerfully that he'd rather just drink straight from the can. "You certainly won't. Here we drink from glasses," Britt Marie interjects with uncompromising articulation.
"Why?"
"Because we're not animals." The boy looks at his lemonade can, thinks about it, and then asks,
"What animal, apart from human beings, can drink from a can?"
Britt Marie doesn't answer. Instead, she picks up the remote controls from the floor and puts them on the table. As soon as she's done it, she bounces back in terror when the until now timid boys on the sofa all roar,
"No!"
as if she's flung the remote controls in their faces.
"No remotes on the table,"
hisses the lemonade boy fearfully.
"That's the worst jinx. We'll lose if you do that,"
yells Omar and runs up to throw them back on the floor.
"What do you mean, we'll lose?"
asks Britt Marie as if he's taken leave of his senses. Omar points at the grown men on the TV, who quite clearly do not even know he exists.
"We will,"
he repeats with conviction, as if this somehow explains anything. Britt Marie notes that he's wearing his football jersey back to front. "I don't appreciate yelling indoors. I also don't appreciate the wearing of clothes back to front like gangsters," she points out, picking up the remotes from the floor.
"We'll lose if we wear our shirts the right way round."
Britt Marie doesn't even know how to respond to such nonsense, so she takes the remote controls and the children's muddy clothes into the laundry. When she turns around, after starting the washing machine, the ginger-haired boy is standing in front of her. He looks embarrassed. Britt Marie cups one hand into the other and doesn't look ready for more conversation.
"They're superstitious. Everything has to be the same as the last time we won," says the boy, at the same time explanatory and defensive.
He suddenly looks slightly nervous.
"I'm the one who shot the football at your head yesterday. I didn't do it on purpose. I'm pants at aiming. I hope it didn't ruin your hair," he says. "Your hair is nice,"
he adds with a smile, then turns to go back to the sofa. Britt Marie keeps her eyes on him, and by and large, doesn't entirely dislike him. He sits on the far side against the wall behind the boy with black hair, and the boy who's had the most soft drink, so that he's out of sight.
"We call him Pirate," says Vega.
She's popped up next to Britt Marie. Apparently, it's what she does, pops up all the time. Her jersey is slightly too big, or her body too small, possibly. "Pirate," echoes Britt Marie, in the way that Britt Marie echoes when she has to drum up all the well-meaning feelings she's capable of, in order not to have to explain that pirate is not much of a name for anyone except an actual pirate. Vega points to the other two children.